it began to show itself that I was not comfortable with myself being withdrawn, being on, to myself, and you begin to walk back the journey that you've come from. And then that is when you emotionally feel, yeah, that thing was really painful. I didn't realize then being held captive was really painful. But then I thought, that's just life. And I think it's just that unsettling bit of stopping to run away from things. I thought, there were times that I thought, had I been still running away from this, I wouldn't have had any problem. Because I wouldn't have had the space and the time to think about other things. So when I was in Pakistan, I was running away from things not to be caught and, deported back to Afghanistan. It was in Iran, you do the same thing. You arrive in Britain, it's an entirely different country, society, cultural norms, language, and then you begin to realize, okay, yeah, and there are more to things that I'd need to, now take stock of what life has been to me and to other people. You get to a position where you begin to think of other people, and that is when, as you get more educated about the world, and then you just, yeah, you'd need to dig deeper into yourself.
Welcome to Third Culture Therapy, a podcast that looks at the unique ways our social identity and cultural heritage impact our mental and emotional well-being. I'm Leila Magribi, writer, journalist, and host of this show. My next guest is Hazara Brit Ro Yacobi. Ro is from the ethnic minority Hazara community in Afghanistan, who have long been subject to persecution in their homeland, particularly from the Taliban. Born in a village in Afghanistan's central highland of Hazarajat, Ro was forced to flee his home village after a day of captivity and torture by the Taliban when he was 12 years old. After his release, he fled to Pakistan and then to Iran, where he worked as a child laborer at factories and construction sites before eventually seeking sanctuary abroad. He arrived in Britain aged 17 in 2004 with, in his own words, nothing but trauma and pain, in desperate need of a home and protection. Since arriving to the UK, he has read politics, philosophy and economics at the Open University and written extensively on democracy, human rights and terrorism for major news outlets, and is an associate fellow at the Human Security Centre. He is a political activist in the UK and the editor-in-chief of Kabul Now and the host of a new podcast called Kabul Cast. Ro, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you join Third Culture Therapy. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on the Third Culture Therapy, Leila.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And congratulations on your new podcast. I know you've just launched one of your own recently, Kabul Cast.
So Kabul Cast is a podcast to tell Afghanistan stories to the world. So that is what it is. We're trying to bring out Afghanistan's stories.
Yeah, that's great. There are so many stories in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, not a place that I have had the privilege of visiting myself, but I do know a few people who have and said wonderful things. So I think it's a very welcome addition to the podcasting world. I want to kick off in Afghanistan, actually, and ask you to describe to us, to me, the audience, who the Hazara are and what life for you as a child in Afghanistan was like, particularly as a member of this ethnic minority.
If you look at the Afghanistan map and you draw a circle in the middle, that is where the Hazaras, so the central highlands of Afghanistan, where the Hazaras, as you said, is home of the Hazaras, called the Hazarajat. The Hazaras are essentially Turkic Mongolian people, as the same as the other Central Asian people. So, the Hazaras, that is where we live, that's what we are. And Afghanistan doesn't have an ethnic a majority country. So it's not an ethnic, one dominant ethnicity in Afghanistan. So it's a country of minorities. So the Hazaras is just one. And because of the, Hazaras have been persecuted throughout the existence of the Afghan state. If you look at Afghanistan today, the state was founded on the crushed bones of the Hazara people in the 1890s. At least 62% of the Hazara population were wiped out, either killed or forcibly displaced. Their lands were confiscated, And ever since the, you know, we as a people have not really recovered from it. And, you know, we continue to live under the shadow of that. And after that, the, you know, being a Hazara, in a sense, became a crime. You know, the Hazaras were subjected to continuous persecution, pushed to the bottom of the Afghan social hierarchy. And as a community, you know, that has not really stopped. So what started in 1890s have not really stopped and is continuing to this day.
You've spoken to the historical sort of origins of this persecution. And I wonder, in the modern or more contemporary context, how did that persecution manifest for you and the community that you grew up within in the late 90s, early 2000s?
The Hazaras are pretty much, because the Pashtuns have been the dominant force in Afghanistan, so they've been ruling Afghanistan. In a sense, you know, the word Afghan is contentious for a lot of people in Afghanistan. Non-Pashtuns normally call the Pashtuns Afghan. So Afghanistan means the land of Pashtuns. And that is why anyone who's not Pashtun is not an Afghan. Because of the Pashtuns being the dominant force and the ruling ethnicity in Afghanistan, the persecution of the Hazaras have been done largely by them. You know, whoever been the ruling dynasty in Afghanistan have had one of their persecuting and oppressing the Hazaras have been one of their things. And as a Hazara, you know, even as a child, you recognize that, you begin to realize that, you know, you look different, you practice your religion differently. And like all other Afghan ethnic groups, Hazaras are Shia Muslims. So, and I've no idea I've not really studied how the rest of Afghanistan's population became Sunni Muslims, but the Hazaras ended up becoming Shia Muslims.
Hmm.
So it probably tells you something about the sense of rebelliousness of the Hazaras. You know, and we've got a saying in the Hazaragi proverb. It's called "Koho Mardumun Moya." It means mountains are our people. You know, the Kurds, you know, they're rebellious people as well in the Middle East, and they've got something similar to, you know, in their social, you know, in their psychology of people. Say, you know, we are mountain people. Of course, the Hazaras are the same, but you as a Hazara, as a child, it's instilled in you where you get up, you realize your position in you know, as soon as you get out of your, you know, Hazara area and go to other places, you're subjugated, you're persecuted, you're abused, and you soon realize that where you stand in the Afghanistan social hierarchy. And, you know, I remember as a child, the mothers used to put their babies to sleep to say, shh. You know, if you're not going to sleep, you know, it says, shh, awomaya means a Pashtun's coming to kill you.
Oh,
so
gosh.
You have that, you know, you got to better, you know, keep quiet or the Pashtun's coming. Awo means Afghan. So, and that is, you know, instilled in you psychologically from a very young age. There are two types of ants in the village. And there was one we called Murche Awo, which means the Pashtun ant. The Afghan ant, which was big, with, you know, strong claws, big head. And then we had at little ones, they're quite, you know, cute, but, you know, smaller in size, head down. And they'd walk, you know, as if they're harmless and they just want to keep at peace. So we had the weaker one was Murche Azra, means the Hazara ant, and the stronger one was Murche Awo. So it kind of, as a kid, you know, you know, you don't have toys to play with. Either you walk around the village and, you know, whatever rudimentary toys you can make out of everything that there is at that time. But, you know, even in the minuscule level, you knew that, you know, the ants. Yes.
You knew where you were in the pecking order.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. And you already mentioned that one of the distinguishing features of the Hazara is that they follow the Shia sect of Islam, as opposed to perhaps the majority of the other minorities in Afghanistan who predominantly follow the Sunni sect. What other distinguishing characteristics or features are there of the Hazara? And I guess the question, sort of to put more crudely, like, how do you know that someone is a member of the Hazara community in Afghanistan?
Well, you look at Afghanistan and you know, the pictures that you see of a turbaned man with, you know, very pronounced facial features, you know, dark eyes and bearded and turbaned, but you never associate somebody with small-eyed, flat-nosed, you know, broad cheeks, people. But you know, any that is the you know, that is what separates not just the religious sect that they follow, but also the feature, you know, the facial feature. I mean, racially different. So we're more Central Asian Mongolians rather than, you know, Middle Eastern, South Asian. So, you know, the origins goes back to that part of the, you know, Central Asia and then far back. So that is this, you know, if you look at Afghanistan, so the Hazaras are easily recognized, and that ease of recognition, in a sense, became easy way to identify the Hazara and persecute them. So in a sense, and that cascaded into Hazara's sense of beauty, that because of how you are, you know, you're ugly, your eyes are ugly. So, you know, this psychologically, the mindset changed. And to other people who were imposing that sense on the Hazaras, you know, you became that, and something at the very bottom of the pecking order. And also, everything was bad about you. A, you're a Shiite Muslim, and you're worthy of persecution. And B, you look different. And that, in a sense, put you even further back. So these are the two distinguishing features of the Hazara people.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the idea that you are sort of being persecuted within a land and the country that you call your own by people who govern you, and that it's so easily doable because of these very physical attributes that you have. So it must be an incredibly scary existence to inhabit, because there's no real escape or hiding. In fact, that might explain the mountainous, I suppose, residency. But also, yeah, I've heard you describe in previous interviews with yourself about living in your community, where it was for large periods of time cut off from the rest of the country and cut off, like isolated purposely, so such that you and your family and your community suffered extreme deprivation and access to materials, is that right, and food?
Yeah,
and
so in 1997, I mean, you know, the what happened to the Hazaras is quite a fascinating thing, you know, until before the Soviets went into Afghanistan. So Hazaras, in a sense, had this sense of, you know, uncomfortable situation, you know, being poor, being persecuted, you know, being at the bottom of the, you know, ranking of Afghan society. But what happened with the, you know, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was the Hazaras realized, okay, the jihad against the Soviet Union or the Soviet-backed government became, in a sense, you know, I think it had, you know, for me, I look at it as Hazaras found themselves, because prior to that, Hazaras, you know, successive Afghan rulers, A, had persecuted the Hazaras, and B, deprived them of the means to emancipate themselves. Either, you know, the Hazaras were not allowed to own guns, the Hazaras were not allowed to go to university, you know, they're impoverished, and all, you know, things that came with that, keeping the Hazaras in check. But what happened during the Soviet invasion and the fight against the Soviets, every ethnic group tried to play their part in fighting the Soviets. So it became a jihad. And the Hazaras came to this awakening, and the groups that operated as factions to fight the Soviets, they came to realize this is an opportunity for us, A, to own guns and fight the Soviets and also claim a place for ourselves in the Afghan society. And it just began from there. And so Hazaras began to gain some power because of, you know, they had experience in fighting. And when the Taliban came along, the Hazaras were their arch enemy. Because one of their first acts when after they, you know, during their capture of Kabul is they killed the Hazara leaders, you know, prominent figures within the Hazaras who were leading the fight against the Soviets and who were playing a big part in, you know, that one of the figures, you know, that kid, he's been the central figure in the awakening of the Hazaras about their own self-identity or self-awareness is Abdul Ali Mazari, for example. You know, the Hazaras refer to him as their Baba, as their father figure, and he was killed by the Taliban in a very gruesome way. And from then on, the Hazaras become blood enemies with the Taliban. And now, because of our geography, we are all surrounded, A, by the mountains, and B, by other people, specifically the Pashtuns on the east and south. And so when the Taliban began to, you know, take places around the Hazara areas, the Hazaras were resisting, especially there was a fight in the east, in the northern city of Mazar-e Sharif. It's quite, you know, and so the Hazaras were resisting there, and they, you know, during that fight, the Hazaras killed a few thousand Taliban soldiers. And that became the sense to punish the Hazaras. The Taliban imposed a blockade in 1997 to, you know, 1999. And it soon, you know, that turned into famine, thousands of people, according to Human Rights Watch and other organizations, thousands of people died, and including my own little brother, out of malnutrition, because we had no access to, you know, enough food, medication. And of course, we were just right in the edge of, you know, the Hazara and the Pashtun areas. You know, on the other side of the mountains were the Pashtuns, they had access to food and everything, and this side of the mountain, we had nothing. So that was, in a sense, another way of, you know, crushing the Hazara's resistance. But that, in at that time, became a thing for the Hazara's. Okay, you know, it's a price worth paying because we're fighting for our own dignity and that sense of self-awareness. So yeah, it was really difficult, you know, because for us the Taliban were synonymous with the Afghans, the Pashtuns, and so we were being persecuted and attacked by Pashtuns. Mm-hmm. So that is how, you know, things were playing.
Listening to the way you describe this life and this clear discrimination, persecution, this battle, this enmity between these two and more groups of people in what is known as Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What strikes me is that for the rest of the world, you know, outside, you know, we look at Afghanistan, we look at it as one place. Perhaps there's an awareness of there being different communities, but for the most part, most of the world just refers to it as this one country with this one people and is treated as such. And I'm curious about how it feels for you as a sort of citizen of this country to actually, from the inside, not really be recognized as a part of it, not really be fully accepted as an Afghan, whether because you don't want to identify as an Afghan or because the ruling Pashtun class don't want you to be identified as such, but nevertheless you inhabit this area that is otherwise known as Afghanistan, and you are genuinely, you know, for lack of
you're not an better Afghan, awareness, but
you're an Afghan, right? You know, like how what does that create in terms of your sense of identity? And, you know, sense of belonging and understanding of where you are and who your compatriots are as well.
I think that has become more of an issue in recent decades than it had been previously, because, you know, in Afghanistan, 60% of the Afghanistan's population are not Pashtuns. So it is becoming increasingly difficult for those people to identify themselves as Afghans. And it goes back to the history of, you know, Afghanistan has had such a bloodied you know, history. But, you know, that identity, that Afghan identity, the successive Pashtun rulers have tried to impose on non-Pashtuns by force. And that worked for some time for, you know, a lot of people, because, you know, they tried to turn that into a collective identity of every ethnic group. But it became problematic in recent decades as people began to realize, okay, A, we're not really Pashtuns. We do not speak their language. We do not have the same concept of history. We've not ruled this country. Our people are oppressed by these people, you know, successively. And also, we don't speak the same language. You know, the Tajiks, for example, speak Persian. We, the Hazaras, speak Persian. The Uzbeks, you know, they're Uzbeks. And they speak Persian, Uzbeki. And so you have Pashtuns who speak Pashto. And it goes back to now as well, that in outside Pashtun areas, the Taliban are pretty much, for a lot of people, an occupying force rather than just rulers there to rule, or the conquerors who've conquered and taken power. So it manifests itself in many ways, you know, in terms of the identity. Mm. A, especially for the Hazaras, you're just different. You know, right. The more you become aware of your history, the more it becomes difficult for you to accept that, you know, identity. In a sense, if you're in Britain, for example, if Britishness were synonymous with Englishness,
mm-hmm.
and if your Scots called English the Brits, and then the Brits, because of being more populous, tried to enforce that identity on the Scots, you know, they would eventually become, you know, that would be pushback. On the other side, for the Pashtuns, they see the people who do not call themselves Afghans as a threat. So that's why right. it's become such a contentious issue. Identity mm-hmm. politics has found its place in the Afghan society. And of course, that is why now you have, you know, the Taliban are a Pashtun movement. They're led by Pashtuns, soldiered by Pashtuns. And now, you know, they're just ruling Afghanistan based on their own values and languages. For example, in my place of birth, you know, you have people, district governors, police chiefs, you know, vice and virtue commanders trying to, you know, A, they're Sunni Muslims trying to, you know, rule over a Shia population. And also, they don't speak the language. And, you know, they're just completely alien people ruling right. over. And that has, you know, that can inevitably create this kind of conflict between people. And that's been repeating itself for decades now.
So when it comes to your sense of sort of belonging, do you feel that in your place of birth? Do you feel that anywhere in that country? Is it very specific? What is it like?
Yes. For me, I mean, because for the Hazaras, they have there's a name for, you know, for the Hazara land. It's the Hazara Jat.
Mm.
Unlike, for example, you know, there's a geography. The Hazaras have a specific geography, and that plays a big part in the Hazara sense of identity. The Central Highlands is actually recognized and called the Hazara Jat. So yeah, you've got an affinity to the mountains. You've got an affinity to the villages that you come from, and there's stronger sense of belonging to that land, the Hazara Jat, rather than to Afghanistan. So right. it's you know, Afghanistan symbolizes everything that the Hazaras would not want at mm-hmm. this moment in time, and now the state is, you know, run by the Taliban, owned by the Taliban, and, you know, they're just an oppressive machine on the population.
We touched briefly on the sort of one of the main distinguishing features being the physical difference in look of the Hazara
yeah.
that makes them easily identifiable, and you touched on how that has an impact on how you feel about yourself and your concept of beauty. Was that something that you experienced yourself growing up, that conflict with the way you look, and or even afterwards, not when you were growing up, but as an adult, have you faced that?
For me, it was a bit different because the part of the country that I came from, part of Hazarajat that I come from, my father was a known figure. He was a commander fighting against the Taliban. He belonged to that movement who were, you know, very strongly, you know, they were the fighting force of the Hazaras against the Taliban. And now the sense of pride in Hazara-ness became one of their rallying cry. And of course, their sense of history, you know, history played such a big part on that movement who were fighting the Taliban. So they were continuously referring to the past persecution of the Hazaras, and their movement and their fight was one for the Hazaras' dignity. So, you know, I was surrounded in an environment where, you know, these were warriors fighting for the Hazara people, for the Hazara identity, for the Hazara's pride. And that showed itself in many ways. And you had Hazara singers, poets, you know, writing songs about, you know, reclaiming the Hazaragi features. Say, okay, you know, your eyes are beautiful, your noses are beautiful, the Hazara girls are beautiful. So it is just bringing that sense of pride back into that people. Say, okay, we've had, you know, we are brave people, mountains are our people. You may want to attack us as much as you want, but we'll defend our dignity. So this thing, you know, it was really a moment or an era of awakening for the Hazaras. And that, in a sense, after 9/11 and the overthrow of the Taliban, you know, manifested itself in a different way. So eventually during the late 1990s, Hazaras were defeated by the Taliban. But that, you know, that Hazaras coming to term and accepting their own sense of self had already found its place in the Hazara populace, especially the younger generation.
Right, I see. So you grew up in an era where there was this resurgence of this particular identity and of a pride that was being built around it, and also a certain defiance.
Yes.
Yeah.
That this is our opportunity, that this is our time.
Yeah.
You know, we had a flag, we had a faction, we had a sense of, you know, a governing structure. You know, the entire Hazara Jat was controlled by one group, and this group was the government, this group was the army, that this group was, you know, the leadership of the Hazaras. This group represented the Hazaras. So this was the group, you know, young men and going there and giving their lives fighting for the Hazaras. So this became the thing. And they, in a sense, symbolized the Hazaras sense of, you know, we've risen up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have kind of, we found our place. And that movement began during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
I see. But then for you, that experience was also somewhat cut short by personal persecution by the Taliban when you were taken into custody at age 12. Is that right?
And yeah. Then... So in 1999, the Hazaras were defeated, the Taliban took over. And now because of my father's position, you know, it was inevitable that the Taliban would go after the family. Now, because my father had already left, you know, they began to go after people who were associated with my father, and then, you know, the circle got closer and closer to the immediate members of families. And then it came to a point where there were not any older adult male left of the family who had not been detained. The Taliban arrived in 1998, autumn 1998. So it was June, July 1999 that I was, you know, taken from the bazaar and then held captive for a day. And then, and that was my experience.
And then you left the country soon after, is that right?
Yeah, so the day after I was released, the family arranged for me to run. I had one of my uncles who were living, there was a small community of Hazaras in Helmand, which is, you know, majority populated by Pashtuns. So the family thought best for me to go and seek refuge there with my uncle. And I went there, and I was there as a relative son who was there to work on the farm. And my uncle had a farmland and they grew opium. So, you know, I was there and I was working on it. And it became apparent after a few months that, A, I was not just, you know, this child who had come to work, because, A, I could read and write, while reading and writing in that part of Afghanistan was not common at all. And, you know, I was more cultured in a sense. I knew more of the world because we had schools. You know, what this group who were ruling the Hazaras had done during their time was also kept the school open for boys and girls, so I could read and write. Mm-hmm. And but when I went to Helmand, you know, these Pashtun boys and girls, I didn't, you know, they were confined, but the boys that I came across and men, young men that I came across, none of them could read and write. And I look back and say, what came off, you know, what those boys and boys came to be, they had no education at all, and the concept was quite alien to them. You know, they ended up becoming Taliban soldiers probably. But yeah, and I spent some 6 months in Helmand, and then from there went to Pakistan and stayed a few months there, and then went to Iran, stayed two years or so there, and back to Pakistan, and then waited for me to get a visa in November 2004, came to Britain.
So you arrive in the UK age 17, you've already seen some of the worst things in life at such a young age. And in your, you know, you've described arriving here with a lot of trauma and pain. Mm. Can you describe a little bit how it was for you arriving here? And I've often heard people describe that during intense periods, you know, of struggle, it's often actually the quiet, calm periods afterwards is when they really have to contend or deal with their emotional and mental wounds. Was that the same case for you?
So the thing for me was, you know, everywhere else that I had been, there was some sort of familiarity. You know, I was in, whether it was in Afghanistan, you know, I didn't find myself, you know, that I was out of place in a sense, although I was, you know, among the Pashtun communities. But when I was in Pakistan, although the language were, you know, there was a large population of Hazaras who, you know, who'd been living there since the 1890s when they fled Afghanistan, some of them. And I didn't find myself out of place. So everything was familiar. I knew people. And when I was in Iran, I could, you know, I speak Persian, so I could, you know, I was not out of place, although it was an entirely different country. But there was a sense of familiarity. I was not, you know, out of place per se. I was a refugee, which has its own troubles, but I was not in an entirely alien world. But when I arrived in Britain, it was entirely different. You know, there's nothing familiar that you can relate to. The weather's different, people are different, the language are different, social norms are different, and you have to learn everything from scratch. You know, social values are different. One of the things I quickly realized was, A, I was very, you know, quiet and in myself, trying to digest what was really happening around me, and B, I didn't know how to behave in certain situations. For example, you know, I remember once we had this tutor. She was following me, and I opened the door and just went and, you know, shut the door on her face. And then a few hours later, she stopped me by and said, you know, in a very delicate manner, said, okay, you got to learn that somebody who follows you, you keep the door open, and it's respectful, and it's, you know, it shows good etiquette. I had no idea that thing existed, as if, you know, that's new to me. So it became, you know, waiting in the queue or at the bus stop, or not just jumping in as soon as the, you know, bus door opens. So it was, you know, you had to continue. I mean, you had to change and learn the whole thing again.
Yeah,
it was not just limited to the language. It's an entire, you have to understand how society works. So it's quite disorientating. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't have the resources around you, if you don't have the support system around you, and you don't know who to approach for help. And as things progresses, you begin to realize, okay, I'm learning bit by bit. There are things creeping up that you begin to think, okay, I'm not really worried about going hungry here. And some of your worries go away, and then the flashbacks of things that you've been through creeps up, and think, you look around you, you see people different, they're more prosperous, and they're happier than you. And then, you know, you begin to question. And in the moment those questions arise, that, you know, before then I had this rush of adrenaline because I was continuously running away from things. But once you stop to run away, there's no adrenaline left. So you have to, you know, that emotion has to show itself in some ways. And it's then that you begin to, you know, realize how much you're affected by your past. And because you've got more time to think, you've got less worries about material things.
Yeah.
And it's then that, you know, takes a toll on you. Emotionally, I thought, you know, before coming to Britain, it was just a normal part of life, whether you're scared of things, you're running away from things, you cry, you laugh. It was just life. But it's just that moment where you stop running that you begin to run from yourself, that thing that exists in you. And you know, you've been running from other things, but now you realize, okay, there are things in me that I'd need to run away from to find comfort, which doesn't bring comfort unless you get to terms and accept things.
Yeah. And how did you get to that point where you were able to come to some terms with some things, and what were those things specifically, I suppose, that you had to come to terms with and overcome?
So for me, you know, it began to show itself that I was, you know, I was not comfortable with myself being, you know, withdrawn, being on, you know, to myself. And you begin to walk back the journey that you've come from. And then that is when you emotionally feel, yeah, that thing was really painful. I didn't realize then, you know, being held captive was really painful. But then I thought, that's just life. And I think it's just that unsettling bit of stopping to run away from things.
Right.
That I thought, you know, there were times that I thought, had I been still running away from this, I wouldn't have had any problem. because I wouldn't have had the space and the time to think about other things. So when I was in Pakistan, I was running away from things not to be caught and, you know, deported mm-hmm. back to Afghanistan. It was in Iran, you do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, you arrive in Britain, it's an entirely different country, society, cultural norms, language. And then you begin to realize, okay, yeah, and, you know, there are more to things that I'd need to, you know, now take stock of what life has been to me and to other people. And I think you get to a position where you begin to think of other people.
Mm.
And that is when, you know, as you get more educated about the world, and then you just... you realize, yeah, you'd need to dig deeper into yourself.
Was there any sort of professional assistance that you sought here in the UK? Or was there any aspect of your culture, practices, philosophy, religion, even the history that you drew on to get you through this time of self-reflection and processing that you're describing?
I think for a time I became very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had, you know, I sensed very severe anxiety. I remember I was working in this factory, and then we had a thunderstorm, and I had a panic. I didn't know what a panic attack was then. Because every time I had a panic attack, I thought, this is just life, isn't it? So, you know, everybody's feeling this way. And I had a very difficult experience of then, you know, you had people watching you, and then you just fall apart because, you know, everything just brings the experiences that you've had. I think it was just then I'm beginning to... It is the sense of loneliness you've got, you know, when you're... among a community of people that you know, there is a sense that you're not lonely.
Yeah.
Because things are all familiar. But when you're not, and then it's just that sense of loneliness that brings all other things together and comes to a head. And I began from then on to realize and begin to think, you know what, why am I feeling this way? Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not right. And there were times that I would... You know, I was driving by then. It was 2006. I'd feel so emotionally distraught, which I could not explain it to myself. I would go into the car park and sit in my car and cry. And it was just one of those days that I was just sitting in my car and cry, that we had this colleague who just happened to walk past. And he just realized that, like, what's wrong with you? He came back and sat next to me in my car, and we chatted, and I said, look, I'm feeling this way and I just don't know what to do. And it was the first time ever that I really talked about my own emotions.
Wow. How old were you at this point?
So 2006. So
you do the math.
19.
So it's a couple of years after you've arrived.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so then he said, why don't you go to the doctor? And so I think the question that I asked him, do you feel this way? I said, no. Nobody should feel this way. And you know, he was one of those guys that I really liked him. And he said, look, you go and speak to your GP. And I came home and I listed a list of symptoms that I had, and I was, you know, having panic attacks. I didn't know why I felt that way. And it was then that I went to seek help. I don't know, probably the bravest thing in my life that I've done. And I went there and, you know, spoke with the GP in whatever limited English that I had. And I just felt, yeah. And he referred me to a therapist. And so me opening up to the therapist, instead of her being able to help me, she was sobbing at every episode.
God.
And then, you know, we had about 10 sessions or something. And it just became that. And I think I tried to self-understand myself a bit more from then on. And then from then on, I think, you know, and also you look at I knew I was in a difficult place, but I could not tell myself what it was.
Right.
Or I was kind of in a total sense of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
That I had not accepted, okay, I need emotional therapy or psychological support in order to get through what I've been through. And I was avoiding that I'm depressed, avoiding the term that I have, you know, anxiety disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was actually the GP who'd prescribed me medication. He'd actually written on the back of the prescription he gave me PTSD.
Right.
And I had no idea what it was. Uh-huh. And I didn't even Google it. And I just thought, okay. And it was, you know, it was then that I was continuously rejected, because it was against social norms. You know, you're not supposed to be showing. You're a man. You know, you've grown to be a man. You're the son of a commander who carried Kalashnikov. And he had, you know, men around him who carried guns. You're somebody who at the age of 7 were able to dismantle and, you know, reassemble a Kalashnikov in, you know, in a minute, and you're able to shoot. So it was just that sense of, you know, boy turning into a man, not showing weakness. And of course, as you'd know, in the societies, especially, you know, that part of the world, these things are taboo, and to be able to come to terms, A, with yourself trying to accept and then make other people accept, is entirely, you know, a long process that I thought, okay, yeah, I mean, I'm depressed, you know, I've got anxiety, I've got PTSD. And until, you know, it took me a few good years to actually accept that I had, you know, I was depressed or I had PTSD, that I began to think, yes, you know, I found that sense of bravery, I suppose, to write something on Facebook to say, okay, you know what, I speak to a lot of friends in Afghanistan and they feel they need, you know, I used to feel that way and they're feeling this way. Can we talk about these things?
Yeah.
And I think it was, you know, I was really scared to put that out, but I did, and I've been open ever since then.
Yeah, I think we really do underestimate, or we can underestimate, the power of acknowledgement, and first first and foremost to yourself of, yes, this was a difficult thing. This was a horrible thing that you endured, that happened. And then you can figure out the ways to come to terms with that, to accept it, to heal from it. But I think often people are, you know, we're not even getting to step one, right? Because we're still in denial, or we're still like, was no big deal, you know, like everyone.
You're scared. I mean, you're really scared.
Yeah, of, I think, exactly.
You're scared of, you know, confessing to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you go through that hurdle, you've not really completed the circle of being, okay, I'm no longer scared of telling to myself, you know, these two minds talking to each other, say, calm down, it's okay. You know, you've been through this, it's okay. And then the other mind talks back and say, but what about, you know, everybody else? What will they think about me? Mm. Or if you find yourself in social situations where you think, everybody's looking at me, and you just tell that mind, say, that's fine. It's, you know, it is these two brains, in a sense, the two people in your head trying to talk each other out of, you know, that position that you find yourself in. And it came to a point where you find yourself that these two people in your head comes in some sort of truce. They say, okay. Yeah, there is, let's agree to disagree on certain things, but let's agree together that A, it's okay.
Yeah.
We're not going to be in conflict with each other. When you feel certain ways, you tell me, and then I can feed back to you and say, okay, yeah, I get what you feel.
Right.
But give it time, it'll pass. And I think every time I have been, I think that has become my mantra, in a sense, that give it time, it will pass.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how low sometimes I am, but I know that, give it a bit of time, tomorrow you'll feel a bit better. And it's just that other person, the person that is scared, the person that is fearful of, you know, the social stigma and the judgments and everything that comes with it, in the end comes to realize, you know, this other bit, you know, this number one, number two people, I accept your, you know, your reassurance, in a sense that you'll be fine. And I think over time, as you grow, it is just that the other person in your head that's trying to calm you down,
if
you've had the right amount of support
and
network around you, if you let that person prevail, but it doesn't come easy. And it's you know, it's a full-on war. I mean, sometimes you know, there are rockets flying back and forth, and it takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Once you get some sort of truce in your head, say, okay, that happened. And also, you know, this emotionally rational bit, trying to convince the other, I get you. Let's give each other a hug. And then when you have get yourself into that position where you've had a hug with yourself, it is just accepting, okay, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And that is the point where I think, you know, I got to where I thought, it's some sort of liberating thing to come to that kind of truth. And I've always kind of, I've always put kind of, I've got it to this two people in my head. That's how I kind of conceptualized it in my head.
Yeah, 100%. That makes complete sense to me. Actually, the way you describe it, I love the way that you describe giving yourself a hug, the truce between these two sides that at least initially can be very much in conflict, like they're having an argument, like they seem like enemies. And it's this process where you get to understand that it's not that one is going to win up above the other. When you have enough perspective to see that both of these voices are working in your interest, it's just that each one thinks that they're doing it in the best way, and that actually sometimes you need to acknowledge, like, for both what they're doing.
I think you'd need to give yourself a lot of time for that to mature. And you know, this is such a pertinent issue, especially, for example, for people who've lived in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a lot of those people, majority of those people, whether they stay in the conflict zones or they get out and find some sort of place of security in the West, they unfortunately do not get to have that experience of finding space to for these two people in their head to come to some sort of... Or because of the social baggage that they... Whether you're a... You know, it depends whether you're a man or a woman. If especially you're a man, you know, this macho character in your head who's trying to say, okay, yeah, that bit who's hurt, you know, that person in your head who's that who's hurt. And it can happen if you're not careful. This other person can really give that vulnerable part a good kicking and say, you know, man up. And yeah, that's a dangerous thing. And I think it takes time. And if you do not get the right support, this other person in your head who's trying to calm the other bit could go in the wrong way.
Yeah.
And it could turn into a very nasty person to say, okay, you're a man, you know, you belong to a society who, you know, you've got to be, you know, you've got so much testosterone that, you know, you got to, you might just give the other person a slap and then in the end you both lose. And I suppose I've been lucky to come to meet people who've been open themselves and then open my own horizon into that world. I find myself incredibly lucky to have had to meet people to get me think, get me read, get me, you know, open doors that I otherwise would not have had opened. And unfortunately, and that's why, you know, this podcast is so important, that you make people realize that that door can be opened to you as well. But just to make sure that right level of support does not exist for a lot of people. And that's when we're talking about this now, me putting it in this, you know, in this way. I hope that other people think about, okay, that guy in my head, you know, it better mature up, read, open his mind to ensure that really he cares or she cares for that vulnerable bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it can be a very lonely experience for both of them.
Definitely. Definitely. But you're right to acknowledge that, you know, there are those avenues and doors and people and books that came your way. But I'd also say it's a two-way street in terms of also your openness, right, and your receptivity to what you were being offered. And then also you then kind of paying that forward and also being open and recognizing there's a whole exchange and a sharing in it. But I want to touch on what you said about society and the sort of expectations or traditions, ideals around, you know, mental health and particularly men. I wonder, you know, in the Hazara community, we've spoken about this history, this long-standing history of struggle and of fighting back, fighting for survival and persecution, starvation, blockade, etc., torture. How has, with all of that being such a continuous struggle underlying the Hazara community, what is mental and emotional health like within it? Is it acknowledged? Are the struggles acknowledged? And how do people overcome or find some balance within themselves? Are there particular philosophies or practices within your community that you think maybe help? Or conversely, are there certain situations in which you think actually this is maybe stopping people from being able to acknowledge and progress or overcome?
Because of the persecution of the Hazaras have been so relentless, you know, it's been, you know, the Hazaras as a community of people have not really had the breathing space to think and reflect. And I think the only way that the Hazaras find some sort of solace is to remain and to continuously remain alert and talk about the injustices that they suffer. I think the Hazaras find that a bit cathartic, but in terms of individual, you know, health and, sadly, and it really pains me to say, I have a lot of friends who are going through similar episodes that I have been through, but you're not supposed to be showing, you know, weakness. It is just it's just that two people in the head have not really got into a position where one side convinces the other. So one of my friends, he was a prominent figure in Afghanistan, a Hazara guy in the field that he was working in. I asked him, how are you emotionally? And he said, look, when I was in Kabul, for me, life was just normal. You'd go out. That was a normal life. You left your home in the morning while knowing that you may not come back. But that didn't feel extraordinary. They just felt normal. But now that I am in the West and I've come to a point where I really don't know what I'm doing. And I said, I asked him if there was 1 to 10 from the, how well you feel at this moment emotionally, physically, and it just affects you in every manner. Where would you put your sense of wellness? And he said, -10,000.
Wow.
And I said, let's talk. And he said, there's no point. And I said, well, I've been through it. Let's talk. And I said, can we get some support for you? And he said, no. And it is just that, you continuously have this big, weight on your shoulders to say, yeah, I can't afford to show weakness. I can't afford to reveal that, there's this other person in me that is really hurt and it's crippling me. And he's just so weak and hurt that, it's really affecting me physically. But it's the prevailing order within, you cannot separate the Hazara community from the rest of communities of people that exist in that region.
Yeah.
And it is still a big issue in the West as well. So it is such a taboo, and it's more of a taboo in places where any sign of weakness can cause, can result in your demise and your death. So
yeah.
I think it's just that is preventing a lot of people to confess to themselves or come to some sort of ease or sense of peace with themselves.
Yeah. That makes, unfortunately, a lot of sense, what you say, particularly about, living life in this constant state of fear and heightened alert, regardless of the fact that we know that not to be ideal. If that's what you're used to and your body is used to and it understands that it becomes a very jarring and difficult thing to comprehend with a different state of being when you are in a place, let's say, where you're technically safe, but you're not mentally so.
Yeah.
But also your point about, the Hazara community not being separate. It is unique in its own identity, but also it exists within multiple communities in Afghanistan that are all in many ways grappling or struggling with the same thing, particularly in the last couple of years, and which is what I want to touch on. We know, obviously, that the Afghanistan fell to the control under the control of the Taliban again, just a little under 2 years ago now. I can't believe it's already almost going to have been 2 years. I just had a shocking moment there because I was reporting. So at the time, I was a correspondent in the UK. I was reporting a lot about that, particularly with the arrival of Afghan refugees to the UK.
Yeah.
So I can't believe that it's already almost 2 years. But what you're saying about refugees who've arrived here, particularly with such a harrowing, very difficult evacuation, very quick process where the whole government collapsed and the Taliban, after 2 decades of them not being around, came, back in power, and all of the sort of hardline policies that they returned to the country. And I guess to ask you, how has that impacted you personally, sort of witnessing this return to something that you fled two decades ago, and you're also an activist. You know, you're very politically active. You write a lot about Afghanistan, about security, about terrorism. You have obviously your publication, your online publication, and now this podcast. And you're also politically active within the UK government, sort of political system. How has it impacted you to witness this all sort of crumble again?
Well, it was personally, you know, incredibly difficult because at that time, when you're a child and you don't understand the world as you would, it is not as painful as you think. You know, it's not affecting you as deeply as it has done to me now. I went to Kabul in April 2021. I knew, you know, how things were. And of course, 20 years of non-stop for the Hazaras, especially the Hazaras, found that as an opportunity to, you know, to experience some other, another way of emancipation. That is to, you know, educate themselves, to push their girls to school, to push their boys to school. And for that to come to an end, you as a person become somebody who understands the values of those things. I mean, if I had not had been educated, had not been to university, had not been, it would have been painful in a different way, you know, but because of the things that I do and because of the things that I'm active in, it became incredibly more painful. And because of me personally being engaged in, it became really hard. And it became personally painful, you know, to be engaged in it. Also being politically known in some circles, trying to affect and bring about, you know, bring people in. The British government was incredibly, you know, awful in that sense. You know, to see, and you look at the evacuation, for example. I mean, because of the position the Hazaras found themselves in, and they were not as well connected, and because they were not well connected, there were not many Hazaras who were evacuated.
Yeah.
So it became, you know, there was a sense of injustice in that. I mean, you know, we often talk to my friends, say, being a Hazara is a disadvantage wherever you go. You know, at the beginning of this podcast, we talked about, you know, the persecution of Hazaras that began in 1890s. We've not really recovered from it. And that continues to this day. And even if you're in the West, you're still disadvantaged and advantaged because of the things that you lacked in Afghanistan. You'll inevitably be lacking here as well. So that, you know, A, the collapse of the Afghan government was painful, although that government had been incredibly unjust to the Hazara people. But to lose that, and then the following, you know, to understand the whole consequence of the whole thing falling apart was one thing. And also to realize how unjust the whole process were, you know, after that was, again, you know, very difficult to stomach as well, especially when you're in the West and you see, you know, you're reminded again that in the end you're a Hazara, and then you're still such a, you know, such a struggle to be one.
Yeah, like you're still not, you're still being treated as a sort of secondary afterthought, or a secondary citizen, you know, not in the primary,
Yeah, and you have to doubly work harder to prove yourself. And that's why there is a sense of awakening within the Hazara diaspora in the West. And because of that sense of injustice, the Hazaras are more well-organized than all other people.
Okay, how so?
And it is because of the experiences of the Hazaras having in Afghanistan, and also that sense of awakening of embracing their own, you know, identity and history. You know, it's painful, but people have comfortably embraced it. It is difficult, but people are at ease to say, okay, I'm proud to be who I am. But there is, on the diaspora side, they feel a sense of incredibly strong sense of responsibility. There are not any Hazara that I know who doesn't strive to make things better for the Hazaras in Afghanistan. And now because the diaspora has got a lot bigger, you know, you get anything that happens inside Afghanistan, you have the Hazaras gathering Western capitals, protests, right. You know, getting politically engaged, you know, getting in touch with political systems. For example, in the British Parliament, there's a Hazara all-party parliamentary group. And there is one in, you know, in Australia, you know, Hazaras are beginning to question and realize that they have a right to ask questions from their government in the West. So they're pretty much part of this, you know, the Western system that they can, you know, ask for help from, you know, accountability and sense of policy change from their government in Europe and America and Australia. So, yeah, and that is something that is incredibly important. And that comes about out of a sense of deep awakening, you know, deep realization of responsibility. I think it's just that responsibility, whether you're a bricklayer or a taxi driver or, you know, a student, you know, when something happens, everybody knows that I have a responsibility towards that people and the injustice that continues.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, you said how the Hazaras are coming to terms with their situation. It is, I suppose, one way that the Hazaras are collectively trying to, you know, direct their energy towards. So maybe it is just that collective person in the Hazaras' collective head leading the Hazaras, okay, I know you're oppressed, but better, you know, direct this energy towards this way. And, you know, that is how it's actually working now.
Yeah, so this historic pain has created a certain activation, is maybe sort of a fuel for people to be active, to get in motion towards this common goal of trying to improve the situation for Hazaras, but also to awaken the understanding around the community, maybe pride within the community, but also among others for their rights and their protection. Which sounds like a beautiful thing, but also given the topic and what we kind of know personally, also comes with this, as you called it, a responsibility. And with responsibility can come certain consequences if not well managed. And so my question to you is, how do you manage carrying this responsibility, which sounds very much like something you're proud and love to do, but have also recognized has this burden within it? How do you personally, Israel, how do you manage the balance, given that what you are aware and understand of your mental health and the struggles that you've been through before? What do you draw on?
I am a political geek. I find myself, I can find my way around politics, and I like it, and I've read, and I have... And everything that I do, I suppose that it's A, there is something in it to say, okay, you're doing it because you have a moral responsibility towards people who cannot do it.
Mm.
You know, the fact that, you know, we're talking about mental health, you know, there is a sense of responsibility in me to say, okay, you need to do this because there are people who cannot do this, whether you're in Yemen or Syria or, you know, Palestine or... you know, Pakistan, it's just, you know, that I suppose a lot of people, you know, in different parts of the world could relate to what we're talking about. You know, my what I'm talking about is not specifically about the Hazaras, but me being perceived as a Hazara is an important thing, because being seen as a Hazara, being active in Hazara, being my face shown around, you know, it is important, because the Hazaras in the, I'm an activist, you know, I want to, you know, there are things that I'm good at and there are things that I'm not good at. And the things that I'm good at, I want to show other people that they can be good at as well. Even if I fail, I tried to be selected as a parliamentary candidate in the Labour Party last November. And I'm intending to do it again, you know, you don't enter any political process or selection or election without, you know, reconciling that you will or might lose. But A, there is a personal ambition there, and B, I want other Hazaras to see and think, you know what, it's good to be, you know, feeling part of this new country that you call home. And one of the things I've really tried hard to campaign on, you know, if you're a Hazara, you live in the West, embrace it. You know, if you're in Germany, call yourself German. You know, that is your land. That's your country. There is no second country. You know, if you're in Denmark, if you're in, you know, America, become American. If you're in Britain, become British, proudly so. Because, you know, there are things you may not like about the host country, but there are a lot of things that you will. You know, it doesn't matter. But because of you being able to make a difference, not just to yourself and to people that you want to help in Afghanistan, you have to embed yourself and integrate into that society, become part of that. Once you're part of that, and that involves as an activist, as much as people's lives in, you know, villages in Afghanistan is important to you, you know, what goes around that village should be important to you. What, you know, the security, the peace, the economic well-being of people. Once you've got that, internalize it and look yourself and embrace everything that is around you. Then you can find your way around and think, yes, I can be useful here. I can be useful to other people as well. And for me, it is just that. And, you know, my main mission, I suppose, is A, I call myself a British Hazara or a Hazara Brit because I have embraced this country. This is my country. Nobody else would have come to say, okay, please accept this country is yours. You know, I have to do that myself. You know, it's a two-way citizenship, a two-way street, give and take. And for me, it is just that if anyone is to, you know, anyone that I talk to, why you're active in the Labour Party, why you want to do things that I do. And I suppose it's just that's being able to participate as a citizen. That is something that we were robbed in Afghanistan. And that is the key thing that I want other people to do as well. You know, become a citizen and practice every right that you have.
Well, do you think that's that practice that it sounds like it from that really beautiful explanation that you just gave, that it's that sort of activity that is bringing you that balance or maybe creating that space within you to process and overcome and heal? Is that right? I mean, that's what it sounded like to me, but do you feel like that is what helps you?
Yeah, and it gives you the sense of purpose, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, if you're, you know, if you're a refugee from Afghanistan, a Hazara in a town in Canada, for example, that is your home, right? And the well-being of people in Canada, in that village, in that town should be important to you. Once you've embraced that, you will become a Canadian citizen. And once you're a Canadian citizen, you would need to be able to practice that citizenship right and the responsibility you have towards that town and that people. But once you've been able to practice and fulfill your obligations as citizens of that place, you will inevitably get yourself into a position where you will be able to help people in the village that you came from. Otherwise, you will just be that irrelevant, lonely refugee that you are. And I think that's not going to help you. That's not going to help people. So it is being able to find a purpose to channel the energy that you have. And everybody's doing it differently, whether you want to protest. For me, it's about, you know, I became a British citizen. I joined the Labour Party. And I did that, A, because I really get excited about politics because, you know, why not? And B, I'm a political geek and I've got my own personal ambition.
Yeah.
And that personal ambition comes from that sense of, maybe, just maybe, you know, I fail and another Hazara guy or girl looks at this, you know, this guy doing that, I can do that, you know, I'll win, you know, I'll become prime minister. I don't know, I'll run Google one day. And I think it's just that because a Hazara is being oppressed and hit on the head all the time that you're worthless, that you're ugly, that you're this and that, we've not really embraced ourselves as such. And I think it's just that there is nothing in me that is less than the next person who belongs to another ethnic group or another community. And once I've done that and I think, okay, I'm no less capable of any other people. I can do the same as what they can do. And it is just that that I want to achieve, if it is for the Hazaras. But for me as a British citizen, as a political activist in the Labour Party, you know, I have a strong obligation to the people of, you know, Britain. I owe this country so much. And, yeah. You know, that sense of my political activism, that sense come, you know, I care about this, the towns and cities and the economy and the society. And it's just that debt that I owe that I want to pay back.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's just that practice of citizenship that comes with it. I pay my debt back to the British people so my children wouldn't have any debt to pay.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you're active on many fronts, Ro, and I have absolutely no doubt in my mind of the many successes that await you. I think you are absolutely an inspiration to British residents, to Hazara community, to refugees the world over, to the persecuted, and to people who have ever felt or been made to feel like they are not good enough. Your story, your work, and more importantly, your openness, I think is really important, very kind thing to share with everyone. So thank you. And thank you for coming on Third Culture Therapy to tell us all about that. I am going to be watching your political career with a lot of keen interest.
It's a greasy pole, they're saying.
I know, that's the only downside. But
I've not really reached that point, at the bottom of the greasy pole yet. So I'm just trying to, you know, clutch and touch it yet. So I've not touched it yet. So
yeah, wear gloves if you can, because it's nasty out there. But Ro, thanks so much for joining. And
it's been a pleasure.
I'll be getting some material from you, things to read and watch, which we'll put in the show notes. But yeah, thank you again, and we'll speak very soon.
It's been a pleasure. Great talking to you.
All right, take care. Bye. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast. Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, leilamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.